Good evening and welcome to The Late Debate. I'm Katie Hannan and joining me in studio I have Neil Richmond, Fine Gael TD for Dublin Rathdown, Stephen Donnelly, Fianna Fáil TD for Wicklow, Kathleen Funchian, Sinn Féin TD. I have you for Wicklow here, but you're not for Carlo Kilkenny. Marion Harkin, Independent TD for Sligo Leitrim, Fiach Kelly, Deputy Political Editor with the Irish Times, Gerard Howland, Public Affairs Consultant and Irish Examiner columnist, and we're going to be joined in a moment by George Lee Ortiz, Environment and Science Correspondent. We want to hear from you, so do please get in touch. You can text us on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie or tweet to @latedebate RTE, hashtag RTELD. Now, we've had just over an hour ago a confirmation that there are now 7 new cases of the COVID-19 virus, and that brings the total in the country to date to 13. Here's the Chief Medical Officer, Tony Holohan, at this evening's briefing of the National Public Health Emergency Team.
4 of the new cases are associated with travel from northern Italy, and they're males in the east of the country. 2 are contacts of a confirmed case, females in the west, and 1 case has arisen which is community acquired. This particular case we're identifying is in hospital in CUH. We're identifying that because during the period of admission, the diagnosis was made after a number of days. And the question of potential contact with healthcare workers and others has arisen.
And that was Tony Holohan, as I say, just coming up to 9 o'clock this evening. George Lee, obviously the number has doubled since yesterday, more than doubled. But clearly from what we heard from that briefing, the issue of serious concern is that case in CUH that is unexplained.
Well, it is serious concern. I think the rise at all is serious concern. But for instance, today now, the chief executive of the HSE was saying that we're in this position of containment, but that it's under great pressure whether you can contain this. And the whole issue was whether you would get community transmission. And community transmission, as described, is that where you have a case that cannot be traced to the likes of another region, such as people who travel to Italy or to Iran or to Wuhan in China or anywhere like that. And it has been the case up until now that each of the cases could be traced in some manner to that. But this case in Cork University Hospital has no connection whatsoever to anybody who travelled, and this person did not travel, and they've been unwell and they've been in hospital for a while. So there are grave concerns about that, because it does suggest that there is some community transmission. Now, what the HSE was saying...
Well, what it suggests basically is that there's cases out there, a case at least out there in the community, and we do not know who that is.
And that's the big worry about where that goes from now. The Department of Health and Tony Holohan was making the point that they're not surprised. They're not shocked by this. That the pattern that we've seen is in line with what they expected up until now. Obviously the only surprise is that we've had this community transmission so far, but we're still in that point, that what they call the containment, where they try and trace everybody. But it's going to be obviously much more complicated now with the situation in Cork University Hospital, because some of the people who were treating that person, they were in hospital for a period of time, for a number of days.
Yeah, they're not confirming the number of days, which
no.
I know people did ask that question, was asked of the emergency team, and they said they weren't going to give us that information. You would have thought that
well, I suppose that's personal information to the patient as well, and you have to respect that, and they can't be disclosing stuff like that anyway, in fairness to them. But even though we all want more information, this is an issue that has been ongoing all day today, all yesterday, about whether or not the HSE are getting it wrong in terms of being too vague about the information, and by being vague, maybe increasing anxiety unnecessarily in some areas.
I heard you asking the chief medical,
and they're adamant that they're not. They think they're getting the balance right. You do have to strike a balance. So the likes of us saying, "Well, how many days was this man in Cork in hospital for, or was he in and out and then back in?" You know, they feel that's not so important. It's that they feel that they have protecting his identity, because if they start revealing people's personal details, you could cause people to go underground in relation to disclosing that they may have symptoms and so on, and that's what they're worried about.
And I suppose the circumstances of the discovery that this patient, having been in hospital, as we say, for a number of days, and then getting tested and testing positive for the virus, that brings a whole cohort of people into his contact network.
It does. other patients and medical workers. And the great difficulty with that is how do you trace all of those other patients, or people who visited other patients? So that is a very complicated thing. So they're trying to trace those contacts, and they're also trying to trace healthcare staff who may have been involved over the years, or over the days, and asking them to self-isolate and so on. So it is a very tricky process that they're involved with.
And presumably,
that's a seriously sick person.
We all know, of course, CUH frequently in the headlines because it is under such pressure. The emergency department there has, you know, a lot of overcrowding in it. Having to send home frontline healthcare staff in these circumstances is another complication in the handling of this, surely.
Very, very difficult, obviously. And because where you need to replace them, and particularly at a point where you do have some kind of a lot of public concern about this issue, if it were to become more serious, you're going to need staff, you're going to need people. Now, and today the issue, that issue was raised at the HSE press briefing by the chief executive and by their officers there. And they were saying, look, it's everybody's responsibility to tackle this crisis and this virus. It knows no bounds. It's new. We're all learning about it. And everybody has to do what they can and take the warning seriously, is what they're saying. And that means look at the advice that they've got on the website, follow the advice in terms of cleaning your hands and the etiquette with regard to coughing, and isolating yourself from people who you think may or may not be a risk, or that you could be a risk to them. And to that, in the workplace, flexibility with regard to that. But it's not, you can't just rely on the health service and the HSE. It is everybody. This is our problem, not the HSE's problem, not the Department of Health's problem. And we all have to play our part. And when you see the likes of that happening today in terms of the first case of community transmission, you realise, well, it could easily get out of hand. It's not out of hand yet. That's important. They're saying that we're not the same as the UK. We're not the same as Germany or Italy or anywhere like that. We still have a small country. They still feel they have it to some degree under control. It's going as they expect, but we're heading in one direction, and that is towards this next stage, which won't be containment, which we'll be trying to deal with the next phase of it.
And no indication yet of how many community acquired cases would have to be discovered before we'd move on.
No, because we're still in the early days. I mean, if you think about it, it's 13 cases so far. I know it has come very fast. I mean, a couple of days ago we had none, and then we had one. We heard of the two going to which had travelled through effectively in 2 different days into the north. Then we went from one which was in the east of the country. That was a male, we were told. Then we were told it was a female also in the east of the country, although probably slightly northeast, people seem to indicate. And then suddenly, out of nothing, we had 4 in the west. And now, of the ones tonight, it appears to me that 2 of them may be directly connected to that, because they are females in the west. And then on top of that, then you have 4 new cases in the east, which were males who had travelled to Italy and came back. And then this unusual one in Cork.
Okay. George Lee, I will let you go. Thank you for that. I just want to go to Kingston Mills, Professor of Experimental Immunology, the School of Biochemistry and Immunology in Trinity College Dublin, who I believe I have on the line now.
Good evening.
Good evening, Kingston. We're just kind of grappling with this because obviously we've only had this news broken to us in the last just over an hour ago. How concerned should we be about, particularly about this community-acquired case?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's changed the situation completely in that up until now, we only had what we called import cases. All the cases we had were people who had come from northern Italy. This recent case seems to have from what we call local transmission. So he acquired the infection from somebody locally in Ireland, and they don't know at this stage who that is. That's another worrying aspect, because clearly there's somebody else out there infected that they haven't identified yet.
I know you have been vocal in recent days saying, you know, that we should have greater, tougher restrictions in terms of travel from the affected region, particularly northern Italy, where all of our, up until tonight, all of our cases had been associated with. Where do you stand? What should we do now, in your view?
Yeah, I mean, I said this yesterday in the media, and I could say it again tonight, that I thought that the advice to curtail travel to what was not called non-essential travel, which is a bit non-specific in that it doesn't actually come out strong enough and say, look, just don't go to northern Italy. And I think that's advice that needs to be given, that either go to Cork, you know, don't travel at all to Northern Italy.
And what about flights coming in? Because, of course, we're expecting some tourists here that may have had tickets for the rugby match this weekend to, you know, take those flights anyway and come to Dublin for shopping or whatever.
I mean, yeah, no, that's the irony. I mean, you know, they asked for the match to be called off, but of course didn't. Just try and stop the 2,500 North Italian supporters from coming here, and they could still come, having booked their flights and booked their hotels, etc. So, you know, there's nothing to stop those going to bars and clubs and pubs in Dublin and coming in contact with lots of people, and potentially, if they were infected, pass it on. So I think the risks are still there to a certain extent, not as great as if they were in the Aviva Stadium, but it's nevertheless a risk.
And in relation to the other issue that we've been talking about for the last week, the St. Patrick's Day celebrations and all the activities that are around that, and the number of people will be flying into Dublin for that.
Well, the St. Patrick's Day parade, obviously a big event in the Irish calendar, and no one really wants to call it off. But the Chinese called off the New Year celebrations in China. And I think if you look at what St. Patrick's Day parades are about, it's about hundreds of thousands of people congregating in the same area, a lot of them coming from outside the country, you know, maybe more from Northern Italy and other infected areas. So you're bringing together people that are infected. What's the difference between that and a match between Italy and Ireland in the Aviva Stadium?
In a general sense, obviously public health doctors and health officials are trying to strike a very difficult balance between keeping the show on the road, as it were, and the economy ticking over and not frightening the horses too much, but also at the same time maintaining this, you know, keeping us in this containment phase. In your view, have we gone wrong with that balance?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I think that the health authorities are doing a very good job in testing and tracking and isolating people who are infected, and you know, there's been no issues with that whatsoever. I think they continue to do so, hopefully. So I think the advice about travel is going to say that I have the issue with, really. We still have a relatively small number of cases here, but we need to make sure that doesn't increase.
And with that in view, would you say literally cancel flights? I mean, we see in Australia they have put travel bans basically in people from flights coming in from various affected regions. Would you go that far?
I'm not going to suggest that on the airwaves, but I'm saying that certainly the travel should be restricted.
Okay. Kingston Mills, Professor of Immunology at Trinity College Dublin. Thank you for joining me with that this evening. I want to go to my panel now. Stephen Donnelly. I mean, obviously, this is a big step up in terms of where we are in the handling of this this evening. To date, you think we've got it right? We're talking there about the balance between the public, keeping the public health side of it versus the, not overdoing it in terms of restrictions.
Yeah, broadly right. There's a few areas I think I'd like to see us go a bit further, but broadly right. There's a huge amount of work going on in the background. The chief medical officer, his deputy, the officials in the department, the people working in the HSE, every healthcare professional working in every hospital, every GP, at this stage, every school principal, every teacher, every taxi driver. You know, there has been a good response from the public, and there has, I think, been a decent response from government. Simon Harris is, I think, quite rightly making his decisions based on the advice he gets from the doctors. I would like us to see us go a bit further. I would like to see the schools directed by the department to not travel. Mm-hmm. We were asking for that about a week or 10 days ago. I think that should be in place.
But surely the advice, non-essential travel into the four affected regions in Northern Italy, there'd be very few schools that would suggest that their school trip would be an essential travel.
Well, maybe not. I know I've had school principals phone me to ask my advice on what they should do. They phoned me to ask my advice on. They've said, look, we have students who've been in the affected areas on holidays. They're coming back into the school. Some of the students, some of the parents, some of the teachers are concerned. The parents themselves who've been away are concerned. What should we do? It would be simpler and cleaner and I would argue more effective to just direct the schools to say, look, there are to be no more trips to the affected zones and probably to areas near the affected zones.
Just for students, just for our more general restriction?
Well, for now, certainly for the schools, potentially for the colleges, for academics who are flying, you know, I think it needs to be looked at more broadly. In the Dáil earlier on today, I raised the issue of the flights for the weekend. Now, in fairness to the government and to the officials, they're following the same approach that the rest of the EU, except for the UK, I think is following, in that there have not been travel restrictions. But we have a unique situation this weekend where we have thousands of visitors coming in from Italy, including from affected areas. We've cancelled the match. If I had the advice that the minister has, maybe I would have a different opinion. But certainly looking in from the outside, it would seem like a prudent thing to do. Certainly to ask the question and say, look, maybe this should happen. Maybe students coming home from...
Sorry, what would be a prudent thing to do?
To cancel the flights for the weekend from the affected parts of Italy.
To put a travel ban on people travelling in from...
Potentially, yeah. I mean, yeah. As the doctor you've just had on said, you know, this isn't about saying a blanket cancellation on flights from affected zones, but it is saying, look, we have a unique weekend, which is thousands of people travelling, many of whom will come anyway, and maybe there should be restrictions put in place for that. So I think broadly, Katie, I think the government is doing well. I know the officials are working night and day to contain this. I think there are a few areas where I'd like to see us go a bit further, move a bit faster. So, for example, the Department of Foreign Affairs only 2 days ago upgraded Italy from green, which is essentially there's no problems, to yellow, which is still only one up. And you had to go layers into the department's website to find any mention of the coronavirus and to find them say, by the way, these particular towns don't go to them. The HSE website is very good. Government communications on the media with RTE have been excellent and are ongoing and are very good. There's much more we could be doing on social media channels as well.
OK, I just got a text in here, Neil Richmond. How responsible would the government be if the influx of Italian fans at the weekend causes cases of Verona or coronavirus? That's from Mike in Galway.
Well, like the thing with this particular weekend, yep, there's about 2,500 Italians meant to travel. Bear in mind that the fact that the match is actually being cancelled means that if they're going through a travel agent, they can get full refunds. So less than the 2,500 will travel. I'll admit, I was hoping to go to Paris for the rugby, so I've been in touch with my travel agent and I know exactly what needs to be done by the French government, French officials, in order to make sure people don't travel. And if you're, that means packages and charter planes and all that sort of things. With the 2,500 fans, the biggest issue is them coming to one central location, the Aviva Stadium, and rugby in Italy is largely played in these four affected regions. And I think the Taoiseach was very clear yesterday morning going in, identifying these are the four regions where we have a very strict travel advisory in. It becomes an issue when you talk about instituting travel bans within the EU, because just because someone is coming from Milan Bergamo Airport doesn't mean that they're not going to drive a couple of hundred kilometres and still come from another Italian or French or Swiss airport.
Yeah, but, and this is where but you could greatly reduce the numbers that would be arriving into the city over the course of a couple of
potentially
days.
Potentially, but it has to be done on an EU-wide basis, because that's when it talks about the free movement and you talk about, I know a number of the flights, the aircraft, the airlines.
Would we have an issue with free? We're not in Schengen, so would we not?
No, but it's the right to move. So if you just say no one from Italy can come to Ireland or no one from Northern Italy, if we have to instruct airlines to cancel specific flights, then it becomes there is legal ramifications that are quite difficult and they need to be teased out. And that's why a lot of, and George is saying it, a lot of it is using.
So you're saying legally
sense.
Under EU.
It's all
EU,
up for debate.
Our EU membership would say we can't. Okay.
No, our EU membership is saying we can't tell people don't come to Italy or don't go to Italy or don't come to Italy. That's where the freedom of movement. And also when you talk about cancelling specific flights or specific routes, it doesn't necessarily directly address it. I think the wider issue is, of course, getting the right information out. And this is the balance, to make sure that people are informed as much. But one of the big things is, because we're still in the containment section of potentially dealing with the coronavirus, is making sure that people are still comfortable coming forward if they have these symptoms, because you need people to come forward if they have symptoms, if they have the virus, in order that you can do the tracing. And that's why you don't go in to putting people's names out. And we saw that with the supposed super spreader who saw his face splashed across the media a couple of weeks ago and was
buried. I don't think anyone is suggesting we need names and addresses of people who
people
have the virus.
They're demanding to know exact locations, but exact schools, and this is where the balance that George is talking about is so key.
Okay, Fiac, talk to me about
the way the media is, the way the information is being fed through the media. Because what we have a situation now where certain medias like RTÉ, we are abiding to the letter of what the HSE is putting out. But other newspapers, yourself, your own included, are going further and putting other information into the public domain that hasn't been released by the HSE, the emergency response team.
I think by and large people are, you know, by and large following the daily briefings, the, as Neil has said, quite effective communication that's coming from the Health Authority's HSE department. But I think the tricky situation the media found themselves in is the fact that, you know, a case is identified, it circulates on social media, it's known in a certain sphere. We, I don't think, have actually gone to the detail of what is out there in social media. We've kind of gone halfway down the road. So we've said if it's in the east, it may be in a specific county. So I think you have to remember that, you know, while the media has to appreciate the job that the health authorities are doing, and they are doing very well, that there is an element of responsibility of disclosure and responsible disclosure on our behalf, our business's disclosure, but to do it responsibly. I don't think that anybody would suggest, you know, breaching the privacy rights of individual patients, but there is perhaps scope to give a bit more information than the authorities themselves may feel comfortable with. And I think even at some of the briefings, it was said that, well, we may not say this, we expect this information to come out. So I think the media has a bit of latitude above and beyond the authorities, but not that much.
Marion, In the sense of, because there is obviously these competing tensions and people are very fearful and they are concerned, particularly people with underlying conditions, with elderly relatives, with, you know, people who are more vulnerable. Mm. And when they hear things like the east of the country or the west of the country, or that a patient has been in a hospital for a number of days, It does worry them that they may have been in contact with these people unknowingly.
Of course it worries people. And just listening to the Taoiseach in the Dáil today, one phrase he used, he said, we will contain COVID-19 for as long as we can. And that was earlier today. When I heard that, I thought escalation is already underway. But we know that's going to happen. But yes, people have huge concerns. And to some extent, I think it's not for themselves. It's not, will I get it? It's, will I transmit this to my elderly relative or to somebody who has an underlying condition? I mean, this morning, many of us will have been with Cystic Fibrosis Ireland, where they spoke about the fact that cystic fibrosis patients are particularly vulnerable group, and they are insistent that they want to speak to government about precautions that need to be put in place for them.
And the minister did meet them this afternoon
I'm happy to hear that. But I think I was listening, I have to say, I'm of the Jürgen Klopp school of thought in the first instance, that it's only experts should speak about this. Yes, as politicians, we're policy makers, but I think we have to trust the institutions we have in place because they are all we have right now. But I was listening to, I think it's the president of the WHO this evening, and he spoke about acting with speed, scale, and clear-minded determination. I think there is a sense out there that because we are still as such in containment, that the speed of action has not been sufficient. But I think scale is hugely important. And I think if people could know that the scale of the response that we have planned is such that it could deal with the escalation that's happening, I think that would be really important. So we heard 20 isolation beds. Yes, but a lot of people know that's not enough. Mm-hmm. The suggestion was made in the Dáil today that we look at lifting the embargo on hiring staff. We spoke about the staff in CUH. Many of them will have to self-isolate, take off work. There was talk about perhaps an emergency meeting of the Dáil around issues like payment to workers who have to self-isolate, self-employed people. All of those kind of things. Looking at, let's say, all the links in the chain. New rules around visiting hospitals, care centres, all of that kind of thing. So I think if people feel that the scale of the response is such that they can feel protected to some extent. I think that's much more important than the information about the east of the country or the west, even though I do know people want to know. But more than anything else, people want to feel protected.
I just see the flavour of the reaction we're getting in. Freedom of travel is a religion to our politicians. We need to put health before the economy, says Joe in Wexford. Yes, it's all our problem now because of people going skiing in Italy. People coming back from Italy should be put into isolation. Our policy is reactive where it needs to be proactive. We are constantly behind the curve with this virus and we are now in big trouble. That's from Tony. People coming back from infected areas should self-quarantine. They should not wait until they show symptoms, says another texter. Never mind the danger zones in Italy, announced danger zones in Ireland is another one. So you can get a flavour of, and that's that. Since we started covering this in the last number of days, this is certainly the tenor of the reaction we've been getting. What are people saying to you, Kathleen?
Okay, so first of all, it's obviously very worrying for everybody, but at the same time, I think we need to try and maintain a bit of calm as well, because even though obviously nobody wants to get this illness, they do say that the vast majority of people will recover from it. I think it's important because some people really panic and they're listening to every single show about this and have themselves totally in a frenzy about it. I would say the schools, as Stephen was saying, are the number one, and it's parents of children getting in contact to say that there's a trip planned, it's still going ahead, or that kids have come back from an affected area and that they've only been told if you're feeling unwell, stay at home. So I think that information is still a bit vague, and I think it needs to be a lot more direct. And I think sometimes when you're dealing with schools, you're obviously dealing with, you know, the management, you're dealing with teachers, and you're dealing with parents and students. So I think sometimes the message needs to be one message clear from the department, not maybe allowing individual schools to make up their own mind on it. But it also throws into light, I mean, our health services. I think that's probably what worries most people. We already know how much our health services is struggling and under pressure, and is there in reality going to be enough beds? So it's really important. I think that the thing the government can do the best now is make sure to reassure people that there will be enough beds and there will be enough staff. And if that means opening beds and recruiting more staff, it will be done. And then the other part to that is the whole area of illness benefit and sick pay, because so many people don't get sick pay, and currently your first 6 days on illness benefits, you don't get paid for those. So little things like that, because people might be more reassured. And
they need to know
say,
this. If you're going to put your hand up and say...
Yeah, exactly. Mm. Well, I won't self-quarantine because I can't afford to. And if there was things like that addressed, and there are small things, but, you know, it's...
They could be important as we go down the road at this. Gerard Howland, it strikes, like, if you following this and following it internationally over the last week or so, it's quite striking that... academics and public health specialists and government officials are coming at it from one particular place. But if you listen to virologists and medics whose speciality is in the spread of viruses like this, they are many of them advocating much more stringent a much more stringent approach by countries like ours that are at the foothills of these. I don't have the quote to hand, but something like, in a pandemic, anything you do before it hits big is going to seem like a crazy overreaction. But afterwards, looking back, it will seem like, you know, completely inadequate. So what's your sense of it?
Well, sense is very simple. We are not China. There's the largest lockdown on humanity in history going on in China at the moment.
But hasn't it worked for China?
Let me get to the point. There is no concern in China about how far the media is going, because the media is told precisely how far to go on a daily basis. And if you want that model of society, you can have those things. We don't have that model of society. They're simply not possible. In relation, for example, to stopping flights from Pacific regions to Ireland, apart from the fact that I understand the impetus for that, it won't work. No place in Europe is more than an hour from a different airport. I just think it won't work in practice. But who has the power to do that? Does a national government? And if so, who's going to pay the compensation when that claim comes, through the European courts or through the Irish courts? In relation to Kathleen's points about workers, I'm self-employed. I'm not particularly enthusiastic about my taxes as a self-employed person used to cross-subsidised sick pay for others, that there's no circumstances under which I will be allowed to avail of. So there's a lot of issues to be teased out here. And in the meantime, you have a real health threat that, given today's development, has taken a step further. And I think the health authorities and the government have, you know, handled it reasonably well to date. And I think the most important thing we can do is in terms of our own sort of hygiene, our hand hygiene, all of these things, to be very rigorous and sort of religious about it in relation to the health system, is what can be done to expand capacity quickly to enable, you know, sort of more patients be cared for. But ultimately, if this goes really seriously, really badly, our health system will not, there just aren't more capacity there under any circumstances to deal with something on a massive scale. And the reality is that this influenza, which is different to others, I mean, it's far less vitriolic than others, but it is 4 or 5 times more than the common flu that we would get every year, and people will die. And this is part of the natural recurring cycle of nature, which, because we're so technologically sophisticated, we imagine falsely we are removed from, but we are not.
I think there's a lot, Katie, though, that can be done to slow Stephen. It down. So the British today have gone into what they're calling the delay phase. Mm. And I think, as several of the panellists have said this evening, we all know that our healthcare system is beyond capacity. You know, the safe bed capacity in a hospital, the EU number is 85%. And if we were at that, then there would be a lot of spare capacity that could be used for something like this. But we all know that the reality is a lot of our hospitals, you mentioned Cork, there's others that are over 100% capacity, which means every single bed in the hospital is used and there's people on trolleys. So we have to some extent, we have to play for time, because there's things we can do if we have the time to expand capacity and protect capacity. So there were meant to be 200 short stay beds taken out. That should be stopped. The winter initiative beds should be kept. But of course, that requires funding. So we, all of us in the Dáil, need to work together to make this happen. I'm not trying to make any political points here at all. There's a hiring embargo in place. That could be lifted and targeted very quickly, particularly for ICU staff, for specialist staff, for emergency department staff.
What about Gerard's point there about self-employed people? There's a lot of self-employed people, and a lot of people, as we know, who are self-employed with inverted commas in the country. Is there any discussion about what could be done to facilitate them having to self-isolate?
Yeah, it's such an important point, because I think protections will be put in place for workers. So at a public sector worker level, I think there was an announcement today.
I see Gerard is smiling.
I'm breaking laughing here. Of course it'll be done for public sector workers. We get that.
Yeah.
But there's a whole rest of the population here who pay for it.
Well, that's the point I'm making, Gerard, is it's already been done. It's being announced for public sector workers, right? And the Taoiseach said today that income supports will be put in place. Kathleen's absolutely right. We can't have people who think, I might be infected or I might be at risk, but I literally cannot afford to go without six days.
Particularly when a lot of those people are people whose jobs involve them going to people's houses, like plumbers or food delivery
or working at a cash register.
Exactly.
Where you're not only meeting people, you're handling money, you're handling cards, you're handling goods. But Gerard is absolutely right. There's an awful lot of people who are saying, look, hang on a second, that's great for my staff, it's great for public sector workers, but if I, as a self-employed person, have to self-isolate, or indeed if I get sick, or if I can't interact with my own customers, then what's going to happen? My income. I think there absolutely is a matter of urgency.
What do you think?
Has to be something put in place for the self-employed as well.
Could that work? Could we do that? Would everyone just get a 2-week free holiday out of it?
No. Well, I think the Taoiseach himself actually brought this up at a briefing we had earlier, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think he raised it in the Dáil initial statements at the start of the day, saying that if something is to be, you know, discovered that can support people who have to take a 2-week self-isolation, that it should be for universal, that it shouldn't be discriminated on from the self-employed to those.
This could be some special payment.
Yeah. But it's the biggest thing is looking at the people who are most at risk are probably at the lowest income threshold, who, like you say, are visiting different homes. We're talking about care assistants, people who are exposed, people who are probably going to be dealing with this in our hospitals or otherwise. So, no, certainly he's brought together, and I think they've already met with people from trade union officials, from employers officials, and the department itself.
And it's Monday, isn't it, that there's going to be a meeting of this subcommittee?
That's the first meeting. There's other meetings that are taking place this afternoon. Minister Humphreys was discussing with people in her sector, obviously in the whole employment area. Minister McHugh had his own meetings in terms of Department of Education, and then they'll all come together and feed it in on Monday. Based on, again, the most important thing is the expert advice of the Chief Medical Officer.
Yeah, Marion.
Well, I suppose just a few comments there. I fully support the idea of income support, a special payment, and, you know, it has to include self-employed. But already I'm hearing from some of the comments coming in and from your comment, Gerard, that I won't say blame, but just it's shifting it a little bit. Somebody is talking about people coming from skiing trips in Italy. Just think about the number of people who cross the Irish Sea every day. There's how many cases in the UK? It's as likely to come from there as from anywhere else. Yes, we know it started from Italy, but it can
be... Well, maybe not quite as likely, because we've talked about 200 cases in the UK compared to 3,000 and something
yes,
in Italy.
Yes, I know that.
Edging towards pandemic as well, probably overnight,
is,
so it is spreading rapidly.
It's happening globally. So I think we need to stop looking over our shoulders to see, is this somebody else's fault? And to follow the advice that's given to all of us as best we can, and as politicians, to put in place, first of all, as I spoke earlier about the scale of the response, and that's been re-echoed by many people here, but also to put in place basic minimum protections for people who have to self-isolate or who cannot work for a period of time. Because those people have to pay their mortgages. Those people have to put food on the table. We have to be seen as a state to move to protect those people. But equally, we cannot be looking to see who do we point the finger of blame at, because that leads us nowhere fast. Mm.
Okay. On that note, we will take a break. But stay with us, because we want to talk about government formation talks after these.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And you're welcome back. Now, there's been numerous leaks from this afternoon's Fianna Fáil Parliamentary Party meeting, reporting that party leader Micheál Martin faced a backlash from his own TDs for opening the door to a coalition with Fine Gael during his interview with Sean O'Rourke this morning. Let's have a quick listen now to what Micheál Martin said in that interview that got his party so annoyed.
Have you decided you're prepared to enter a coalition with Fine Gael?
Yes. Again, depending on a programme for government that works and that represents a new direction in terms of housing, health and climate change. And also, I'm very strong, because Fianna Fáil has historically been very strong in education. And one area of that that annoys me and frustrates me, and why I'm very anxious to get into government, is to transform the experience for families with special needs children once and for all.
And that was Micheál Martin saying, I suppose, what we've all been guessing and speculating, Fiac, that this is his clear intention now to try and form a government with Fine Gael.
Yeah, in a way it was no surprise, but I think it was the blunt manner in which he said it, and then he followed what we heard there quickly by when he was asked, will you consider a rotating Taoiseach? He said, I'm ruling nothing in or ruling nothing out. And that interview seems to have set off quite the chain reaction across the Fianna Fáil party. There was something of a mini revolt at the parliamentary party meeting against his, narrow focus on one set of talks only with Fine Gael. And it was wider than the usual suspects. You know, we've heard John McGuinness, we've heard Eamon O'Queeve say the Fianna Fáil talk to Sinn Féin. The discontent was wider. It was people like John Lehart, not known as a rebel, deputy whip of the party, Robert Troy, frontbench spokesman. And then you had other people issuing veiled criticisms, but not directly addressing the point of talk. So,
yeah, Jackie Gall, I saw being quoted from that meeting saying that there has to be a root and branch.
Yeah, he said there has to be a root and branch review. This was at the last parliamentary party meeting as well. Stephen might know. I think this was called for before, and there's suspicion among some TDs that they won't actually do a review unless Micheál Martin's feet are held to the fire on it. But I think other people spoke about the strategy of repeatedly and strongly attacking Sinn Féin. They felt it was backfiring on Fianna Fáil. It was only allowing Marilyn MacDonald, I suppose, further her outsider status. And I think a couple of people raised that in a roundabout way. Sean Fleming, I think, said it would be like Tesco giving Dunn Stores free advertising or something like that. But they were all talking around the issue of Sinn Féin, but not really addressing it. And Micheál Martin reacted quite angrily, from what I'm told, of the meeting, and said
we might get a slightly different version of that in a moment. But were you told, Fia?
Said that, you know, the parliamentary party meeting, the first parliamentary party meeting after the general election, gave him a mandate to talk to other parties about government formation, except Sinn Féin. And Micheál Martin's position was, well, you can't tell me to do one thing one week and then a fortnight later tell me to do another thing. So I think it broke up on that point, and there's a bit of, you know, I think some Fianna Fáil parties are a bit sore now. They're looking at Sinn Féin sore in the polls. Like, if this Fianna Fáil Fine Gael government takes office, and I think, you know, Joe Flaherty, the Longford West Media TD, said at the party meeting, it would probably be one of the most unpopular incoming governments in a while. So I think there's a lot of sore people in Fianna Fáil at the moment. I think what we saw tonight was a reflection of that.
I'm probably quite worried as well about
probably
the implications
quite worried,
of what, yeah. Okay, Stephen Donnelly. Is that a fair reflection of the meeting you were at this afternoon?
Well, I bow to Fiach's superior knowledge of the meeting, because I was at a coronavirus briefing for the vast majority of it. I did come in at the end, and
was there fisticuffs in the
aisles? No. Micheál wasn't angry at all. I mean, he reiterated that he was following the mandate, A, that the party ran on, and B, that the parliamentary party reiterated wholeheartedly 2 weeks ago. You know, so no, I don't think so. You know, it is a difficult time for everybody in politics. Like, everyone who's been elected to Dáil Éireann wants to see a government put in place. We're all very conscious of what's going on with the coronavirus. We're all very conscious of what's going on with Brexit. And every single man and woman in that chamber wants to see solutions in health, solutions in housing as quickly as possible. We all want to see these things change. And so I imagine everyone who's elected to Dáil Éireann has a sense of frustration and wants to get on with things so that a new programme for government can be put in place and so that we can begin making things better for people.
Would you, if you hadn't been conveniently at another briefing, would you have chipped in that those exchanges about the rhetoric around Sinn Féin and how that might have backfired on the party? Well, what's your view on that?
My view is I think Sinn Féin had a good election. They got they're not the biggest party, but they got the biggest share of the vote, and they deserve great credit for the election that they ran. I think what Sinn Féin have done is they have...
I'm not talking about what Sinn Féin has done, I'm talking about what Fianna Fáil did, what Leon Martin did in the course of the election, and whether that contributed to Sinn Féin's current position.
Yeah, no, you're asking me what I would have, might have chipped in. I think what Sinn Féin have done very well is, I think they have won the interpretation of the election. You know, and we've seen they did very, very well in the recent poll. And all politicians say they never look at polls, and all politicians look at polls. That's just the reality. But look, ultimately, I don't think any of this matters, Katie. I think what matters is that there is a government put in place, be it a Sinn Féin-led government or a government with Fianna Fáil.
But sorry, Stephen Donnelly, many of your colleagues clearly think it really does matter, and that it has greatly undermined the position of Fianna Fáil as it stands, and that this was a strategy, an ill-thought-out strategy, that has been pursued by your party leadership.
Well, all I can tell you is what I think. I wasn't there. And what I think is that ultimately what people want to see is a government in place taking radical action to make things better.
I think one criticism in particular, from what I'm told, of the meeting stung, which was Robert Troy, who is like a front bench spokesperson on transport, was transport, I think he might be a different brief now. He took issue with Micheál Martin's repeated claim that shadowy figures run Sinn Féin. And he said, we all have unelected people in our party who make decisions behind the scenes. And I think that really irked Micheál Martin, because that is a charge he has made repeatedly throughout the election campaign. And I think what's bothering the people I was speaking to tonight is not so much the election campaign, but that this has continued after the election campaign.
And particularly the strategy of not speaking to Sinn Féin. Perhaps you say you have a mandate not to go into government with Sinn Féin, but to not even have a conversation with them and to rule that out so vehemently, so frequently. Do you think that might have damaged your situation?
Well, look, maybe, maybe not. I mean, our situation is as it is, right? The election has happened and all of the various parties and groupings have the seats that they have. And it's incumbent upon all of us, upon Sinn Féin, Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, the Independents, on everybody to try and form a government. Okay. So if this conversation were happening before the election, where it would have an effect on the numbers in the Dáil, then maybe. But that's why I'm saying all of this to a great extent is navel gazing, because all that actually the people have returned the dole that they have returned.
To a certain extent, it's not, because any programme for government has to go before a special ordesh now, and your councillors are making their opinions known as well. So this will set the mood for a debate in the party that everybody says is going to be a challenging debate. It's not like the parliamentary party can present this as a fait accompli to the organisation. The organisation has a say now. Yeah. And after that interview today, a wildfire seems to be set off at certain levels of the party.
Well, I don't get any sense of a wildfire, but again, I bow to your inside knowledge. But look, what matters, what will matter to the membership of Fianna Fáil, just as it would to Sinn Féin, to Fine Gael and to all the other memberships, is the programme for government. What every member of every political party will want to see is a programme for government that delivers.
I'm not sure that
change.
That is the number one thing. I will be one of the considerations, but not the only thing that matters.
No, of course it won't be the only
member of Dublin City Council tonight. Yeah. There's a bit of an effort amongst your 11 councillors on that council too. Get a coordinated statement out opposing this, because they think that it's damaging the identity of the party. And bear in mind, last year in the local elections...
Sorry, opposing this idea that we're
coalition with Fine Gael.
Coalition with Fine Gael, like,
now, I don't know if this statement will come off, but there's a large, strong opinion within the councillor ranks of Dublin City Council, because bear in mind, at the last local elections, that was seen as a strong point for Fianna Fáil, because they were seen to win back support in working class and lower middle class.
By ruling out...
Well, this idea that you go in with Fine Gael is really worrying them, because they think, you know, the people who represent working class areas are saying, what about us when we go out to working class areas again to try and say we are Fianna Fáil, we are different.
Yeah. Okay, let's talk about Fine Gael. Neil, you've been very quiet there, and you've been very quiet generally. I mean, listening to Simon Harris saying that, you know, a crunch point will come, but, you know, there's several more weeks left in this before, you know, we go into government formation. I mean, God, like... When are you going to accept the situation that has been presented to you and get on with it?
Well, we have accepted, and we've started discussions with detailed policy discussions with all groups. And I think Taoiseach even wrote to the leader of Sinn Féin looking to have a discussion, and we're prepared to talk.
But while insisting at all times that you want to go into opposition?
Well, we don't want to go into opposition. Unfortunately, that was the result that came to us. And usually under ordinary circumstances, if you've been in government for 9 years and you return with significantly less Dáil seats and 20% of the vote, you automatically would just go into opposition.
See, we've had a succession of Fine Gael TDs in the studio telling me that, you know, we lost the election. We lost the election. You lost significantly more seats in 2016. I didn't hear a single member of your party suggest that was a losing election for Fine Gael.
It's interesting to go back to, well, it wasn't a losing election because we remained the largest party. But one thing about this is, and it's quite similar to 2016.
But 2016, you never said that was a message from the people to tell you get out of
2016
of power.
Was something seismic in Irish politics. For the first time we had confidence in supply. It took over 70 days and 4 Dáil votes to get there. We're now at a situation where there is no longer two big parties. There's 3 medium-sized parties, and we're trying to form a government or allow people form a government on that basis. We're less than 30 days into this Dáil. We've had 1 vote, and we've had a situation for the last 4 or 9 years that the vast majority who are in the Dáil now have been trying to get us out. So just because certain groupings of numbers together give an easy conclusion doesn't mean that this is going to be quick or easy.
Hang on, let's just remind ourselves what your party leader said less than 6 weeks ago in the middle of the general election. Do we have that?
If the numbers fall a certain way, and the only way to form a stable government is for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael to cooperate and come together, I think that's the responsible thing to do for the country.
So, there you are, the responsible thing to do for the country.
And 34 and 37 still don't give you a Dáil majority. So there's going to be... No, this is important, Katie. And this is why the Taoiseach has been quite clear that we'll enter into serious policy discussions. We had good sessions with the Green Party, with Fianna Fáil, with groups of independents the last week. Because we're not going to go into the government just for the sake of it. And even when people were talking automatically about rotating Taoiseach and numbers in cabinet, it's about trying to push forward your agenda. Our party identity is still the same. Our priorities in terms of what we ran in the election for and didn't get the vote necessarily we'd like for haven't necessarily changed. We're not going to go into the government for the
sake
of it.
We're nearly a month out of that election. You haven't even put together a negotiating team if you are in any way serious about acting responsibly as defined by Leo Varadkar 6 weeks ago.
And we've already started our exploratory policy talks to see if there is a point. And the Taoiseach has said to us quite clearly, he says, when I have a mandate to enter government negotiations from the parliamentary party, I will do so. But he hasn't come to the parliamentary party looking for it. What he said again today, which is he said the last two meetings, is that we need to have the discussions. He's happy to, I think he's meeting Micheál Martin again next week, and hopefully he will have that meeting with Mary Lou McDonald before the St. Patrick's Day trips kick in.
Gerard Howland.
Firstly, in relation to Fianna Fáil, it's not primarily about forming government. It's, for them, it's about survival, except as a semblance of, you know, something so small that it wouldn't be recognisable. I think
it does make this coupling, or we want to call it, quite unbalanced then, doesn't it? Because there is a sense that it's like the girl being asked to the debs and the girl saying, I don't know, ask me next week again.
Yeah, I mean, this is a win-win situation for Sinn Féin. I think Fine Gael has a significant problem, but a far smaller one than Fianna Fáil. At the end of the day, there's a certain portion of the population who want a Fine Gael-style party to represent a right-of-centre economic viewpoint. Fianna Fáil's problem is that Sinn Féin, as is, questions the need for a Fianna Fáil that is no longer rooted in vast tracts of working class housing estates across the country. And because Fianna Fáil was in office and government for so long, because they were so successful, Fianna Fáil people are largely, and this is a credit to them and what they achieved, living fairly middle class lives by and large, and they're much less present, and within their membership is much less present, large numbers of working people. So the class profile of the membership has changed. It's also aged, as it has across all parties and voluntary organisations, and it no longer in the 21st century appears to have the mission it had for all of the 20th century. Because if in the 70s and 80s it appeared to flounder somewhat, come the 90s, particularly with the peace process of the Good Friday Agreement, it refound a mission that was very much in theme with its own original makeup. Yeah. Now, all of that is in question. And for Stephen Donnelly and his colleagues to go into government with Fine Gael, to leave Sinn Féin in opposition, where they will be delighted to remain, will be a catastrophic political mistake.
So what are their options? Throw themselves out in the mercy of the people another
first
election?
Of all, I think the first thing they need to do is not be rustled by important commentators like yourself in reminding them that it's a month since the election. The answer to that, Katie, is very simple. So what? If it could be 3 or 4 months, we might get seriously concerned. There's huge issues at stake. The voters, in their wisdom, decided...
But the numbers won't change, Gerard.
The numbers won't change. So, but the facts may change eventually. And I think Fianna Fáil, I think, have to wait for Fine Gael to eventually show its hand. And eventually, the Taoiseach will have to seek a dissolution of the Dáil. And it's very questionable, in my view, whether he'll be granted it. And it's at that point, perhaps, that a real move on can happen in a Dáil where a dissolution has been refused.
Marion, if you can keep it brief, because I want to get Kathleen in as well.
Yeah, well, look at the numbers. We have no government and we have no opposition in all of that. And I think we need to talk. And if talks fail, they fail. But the people out there need to see that that effort is being made by the political parties. Mm. And this was an election about change. Mm. And I can see in that context why Fianna Fáil are reluctant maybe to go in with Fine Gael and vice versa, because they are not seen as the parties of change. But change isn't just about Sinn Féin, it's about Greens and it's very much about independence. So there's a lot of players there. But if we don't talk, if we're not seen to be actively and constructively engaged, all of us with one another, then people, I think, will get angry. And I agree with Gerard. Time is not as important. Everybody wants it done yesterday, because then we move on. What's the next thing? The most important thing is to get it right, but you can't get it right if you don't talk to everybody.
Kathleen?
I do think people are probably frustrated with the length of time, because they maybe not fully understand the whole process. But I think if they could see that there was actual meaningful negotiations going on, they might actually, you know, be more understanding of that. People did vote for change. It's nearly becoming a cliche now to say it at this stage, but they did, and not just for ourselves, as Marion says, independents, Greens, Social Democrats.
But isn't Gerard right? Aren't you on a win-win situation here?
Well, the thing is, we've said we'll talk to everybody, and that's still our position. And I think the difficulty for Fianna Fáil is people don't like the exclusionary tactics that they've taken in relation to ourselves. And an awful lot of their supporters, in particularly in rural areas, would actually love to see them working for Sinn Féin. We're working with Sinn Féin. So I think that's the difficulty for them. I don't usually concern myself with what Fianna Fáil's difficulties are, but if I think that's, you know, a good assessment of it, particularly in rural areas. But we do need a government, and we do need to be a lot more serious about that. People really do need to sit down. As we've said, we're already speaking to a lot of different parties. We're open to speaking to every party because we are serious about it, because all those issues that people brought up during the election
and I'm being seriously
have not
told
gone away.
I have to take this break. I'm sorry to cut across you, Kathleen. We'll go to that break.
The Late Debate with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
And we're right out of time. Just time for the credits. Tonight's programme was produced by Brian Lally. Research was by A.B. Philbin Bowman. The broadcast coordinator was Elaine Conlon. And Kieran Cullen was on sound. I want to thank my panel. Thank you all for listening, and hand you over to Colm Murray on Late Date.